Hi, my name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Eric.
Thanks for asking me to come up, Billy. And thank you guys for riding with me, Omar and Bruce. It's one of these things, we just don't do this alone. My sponsor's always like, make sure you bring somebody with you. You know, and I want to start thinking about the things that you think about, Eric. Which could be like long lists of stuff that I'll think about. But anyway, so it's nice to travel around and go anywhere where I'm asked to go or do whatever I'm asked to do. I didn't want to come into AA. I didn't really want to stop drinking. And the fact that I'm sober today and I'm here, that's really God's grace for me, and I believe that today. But I have a couple things I want to share with you right at the beginning. I've got a sobriety date. It's an important thing. It's January 20th of 2000. I also have a home group. It's the Outlaw Safecracker Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we just started this up in January, and we're having a lot of fun. It's a speaker meeting. It meets at 8 o'clock on Monday nights at the Reveille United Methodist Church in Richmond. And it's just great. We have a lot of fun there. And it's good to be a part of a structured group and hear a clear message. We try to get speakers to come in and just talk with their experience with alcoholism. That's what we're here for, you know, and that's what I have. I'm a real alcoholic, and I'm planning on sharing that with you tonight, too. So anyway, I also have a sponsor, as Billy mentioned, and I am a sponsor. So these things, from what I understand, and my experience has been, it keeps me in the middle of the AA. I'm not kind of on the edge. I'm not moving away from the herd. And I've had times I've done that, too, you know. So anyway, but I'm in the middle of this deal today, and I practice the things that AA suggests I do. Suggestions, requirements, we'll talk about that, too. But anyway, I'm glad to be here tonight. So it's funny, I was thinking about a guy that I sponsored, his name is Casey. He's a funny guy. We go to this Thursday night meeting, and it's a very loud, boisterous, a lot of activity, a lot of rustling around going on. We're going to talk about before the meeting. We have a statement that we read at our group, you know, try to get your coffee, you know, and please remain seated while the meeting is going on. And this Thursday night meeting was getting so loud at one point, and Casey's like, you know, he's like, hey, called me up and said, what are you doing tonight? I'm like, I don't really know. And he's like, I'm going to go over to the Thursday night bar fight. And it's as it sounds, like a bar fight in there. I mean, we've got regular cups that are clanking around. And anyway, he's just an endless source of comedy for me and the rest of us. He's a good guy. So it's not so much of a negative. But, coming into AA, I didn't have very many good habits at all, you know. And one of the first things that people were suggesting I do were things like that, you know. Try to be respectful of those around you and try to, you know, start doing some things, Eric. I can hear my first sponsor now that you haven't been doing before, you know. And anyway, and it's been like that since I've been here. I've had sponsorship that's given me pretty clear-cut direction from their experience on what I'm supposed to do to try to change, because I need to change to live. So, but we'll start off really with what I used to be like. What was Eric like when he drank? I was a slob. I was just I'm a daily blackout drunk. Is where it ended up for me. And I was like that for quite a while. I started somewhere in my early teens. I was warned about drinking. My mom all my life said, you know, you might want to stay away from the booze. You know, it runs in our family. My mom is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. And all my life, my brother and I were warned about alcohol, you know. And so I just was afraid a lot of my life about whether or not I was or wasn't one and all that kind of thing. And, you know, until I took the first drink, it really wasn't around that much. But, man, when it came about and the opportunity presented itself, and really what happened was the friends that I had made at that point were drinking, and just there was no fight for it. You know, I just went ahead and gave it a shot. And it wasn't so much like the big 4th of July experience at that point, but my experience at that point was, this is no big deal. All the warnings that my mom had passed on to me, I just kind of felt like, what's she talking about, you know? I don't see anything but a good time here. I'm going to enjoy the good time, you know? So I started out, and I do remember the first time I really got wasted, and that wasn't such a big thing, except for the hangover the next day. I'd never felt like anything like that in my life, and I swore that I would just never have vodka again, you know. I mean, that was just, I believed it. I mean, I really believed it. And that was just, you know, my first experience with delusion, because that was not what would happen, you know. By the time I graduated high school, I was putting away a fifth of vodka a day, you know, no problem. I could, that was kind of where I was, 18 years old. And, you know, throughout high school, it was just, you know, weekend binge drinking with all my friends and all the silly stuff that goes along with that. If you started drinking in your teens, you know what I'm talking about. And my behavior wasn't so much frowned upon. It was just fitted right in with everybody else. And I just didn't understand it and had any idea what was going on. And I just was like, this is great. In fact, I visioned the rest of my life being like high school, you know, popular. The ladies love me, you know. I've got this great thing with booze. When, you know, all the time, whenever I go for it, I'm comfortable, you know. And I was comfortable without it at that point, and then I was comfortable, even more comfortable with it. There were times when I could take it or leave it alone. Something was real important, and I could do that. But I did start drinking in the morning a little bit on the way to school, kind of as a camaraderie, kind of a joke, is what we were saying. You know, it'd be kind of funny. And I started doing little things like that, and by the time I got out of school, like I said, I was a daily drinker and consuming quite a bit, but I could still take it or leave it. And when I left high school, most of my friends went off to college. That was not really in the cards for me. I envisioned myself being more along the lines of fame and fortune. That was kind of where I was shooting for, gearing up for the music industry. And so I went to Los Angeles, and I moved out there with a band that I joined, and gave it my shot out there for a couple of years, and it was difficult. It's difficult being 18 and really enjoying drinking and being separated from alcohol, as I was many times in Los Angeles. You know, I was with a group of guys that were responsible, you know, more responsible than I. Some of them are married, and they're expecting me to be at places at certain times and expecting me to, you know, contribute as a member of a group. And I was unable to do this, you know, like the rest of them. And I started developing this thing, as I know now, resentment came about. And it was just uncomfortable for me in Los Angeles because I was unable to drink the way that I was accustomed to drinking before I left there. And I just didn't feel a part of what was going on. And it was a lot of binge drinking was going on for me out there, too. And I would stop because somebody's getting on my back. And then I would, you know, go off on a bender again, and then I would stop, you know, and I wasn't paying my bills, and I was getting kicked out of one place. I lived in seven places in a year and a half, and that's normal. People don't have situations like that, and that's not what regular people do. We get a place to live, maybe we buy a house or get an apartment, sign a lease, and you're there for a while, and I was just kind of hopping around, and I was drinking and driving a lot, and I went to spend my first jail experience out there as a direct result of, you know, of drinking. And, you know, I just got fed up, and I was I had a resentment that I could not lick. I just didn't know what to do with all this pain inside. You know, I hate everybody around me, and I hate California, and I hate everybody in the band. And nobody will listen to me. Nobody respects me. You know, I'm such a victim. And so I left. I quit, and I came back to Virginia. And when I got home, reunited with all my friends, and it was just like a big welcome home party at that point, you know. And I was about 20 years old, and long hair, skinny. It looked like, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years older than I really should at that age. And, you know, just a little ridden down. And I just started drinking. And for the next decade, I just didn't stop. I mean, I just went at it. And I found employment in the restaurant business as a result of getting a haircut and taking some action. And that worked out good because I ended up meeting and hanging out with people that like to do what I like to do. You know, people, whether they're alcoholic or not, it's really not the point, but I was going out with people every night after work and just getting drunk, and had lots of money in my pockets, living at home. It was kind of like, you know, high school again. I was working, no bills, drinking a lot, you know, that kind of thing. And my mom was getting kind of sick of what was going on. And I got into a relationship in the restaurant. It fell apart, and I didn't know what to do because I was just been a taker all my life at this point. I didn't understand what was going on, and why did this person love me, and why wasn't she giving me every, you know, why was she picking me, and all this kind of stuff. And I did not have any idea on how to do this. And my solution was the same as it was leaving California. I just quit, and I leave town. Something doesn't work out for me, I got to leave wherever I'm living, you know, leave my job and go away. And so I came to Richmond, and I got into VCU. And I borrowed a whole lot of money from the government. And I figured that school would be, you know, the politically correct thing for me to do at this point. And so I got all this money. I get into music school. And I'm living with friends, you know, and living from, hopping from one place to the next, you know, year after year. And a couple years of the way I am and the kind of drunk that I am. Let me tell you the kind of drunk I am. At this point, I had lost the ability to control my drinking. I didn't know that at that point. But that's where it was for me, about 20, 21 years old. And I'm the kind of guy, when I get drunk, I just fall down. I break things in your house. I steal things. I don't tell you the truth. I don't pay the bills. You know, I do all this kind of stuff. I was pretty much just kind of tapered off on my eating at this point. You know, people are getting sick of my behavior, and they're sick of the way I am. You know, the power to choose whether I drink or not was gone. You know, I had developed, the mental obsession was in full swing. I had the allergy, you know. Whenever I'd stop, my skin would start itching a little bit, and I'd hear things, and I'd see things that weren't really there, you know. And it was just really uncomfortable to not drink, you know. It was hard. I couldn't figure out how to not drink peacefully, you know. It wasn't an option. And I was just, more and more as I got into it, I was just more and more sold into this, you know, I'm going to be drinking no matter what happens. And so the years are kind of clicking off, and the jobs are kind of clicking off. And I discovered living alone. And it was a little surprise to me that nobody wanted to live with me at that point. On one hand, and on the other hand, it really wasn't. But I got my own place, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm king of the castle now. You know, I got my own place. And I don't know about y'all, but I drinking alone was like the greatest thing I ever discovered. I mean, it was nothing like it. It's peaceful. Nobody's pestering you. Nobody's going to come at you, and we're going to have to talk about your drinking, you know. It's the worst thing when somebody wants to come up to you and talk to you about the way you're drinking, you know, your behavior, you know, do you remember what you did last night and all this kind of thing, and you get that icy kind of feeling in your chest, you know, and somebody knocks at the door and you're afraid to answer it, you know, and don't look in the mailbox and don't answer the phone. And these are the kinds of thoughts and fears that I'm having. Then, you know, I'm not worried when I hear the phone ring today. I'm not ducking. The mailman calls me Mr. Mitchell. I was like, he caught me off guard last week. I was walking, I was like, hey, how you doing? He's like, hey, Mr. Mitchell. I'm like, whoa. Damn, I mean, I'm somebody sober, you know. And that's what's going on over there. And the mailman wasn't calling me that, you know, and that wasn't what was happening. I was terrified of everybody and everything, and I just couldn't remember. We were talking about blackouts on the way up here, you know, and, you know, Omar was sharing some experience with me about coming to in the middle like a quantum leap type of a drinker, you know. I'm not the quantum leap kind of guy. I'm like the just can't remember what's going on at all blackout guy. The 90s are just really unclear about what was going on. And I missed, you know, I was a musician. I missed bands that came and went. Albums came and went, you know, relationships. I don't know. I'm sure that I had some. They came and went. And so drinking is paramount above all else in my life. And I'm giving away everything willingly, happily, you know, in order to get a drink. And I became a regular at the Jefferson Loan Shop, hocked all my music stuff. And I'd go down with my financial aid and I'd pull it all out, you know, and then I would take a cab down there and pick it all back up. I lost my license at 21 and didn't see a need to get a driver's license back. You know, I don't know why you need a driver's license. I think I knew that I would get pulled over for a DUI again. You know, if I get the second one, we're going to quit drinking. That's what I was telling myself. And so I'm telling myself whatever I need to tell myself to be comfortable with the drinking. You know, I'm just kind of holding out that it's all going to work out okay. I'm going to take that turn in the road maybe that I see the rest of my friends doing. You know, they're getting married. They're having children. I'm going to some of the weddings. I'm not getting invited to a few of the other ones. You know, making a mess here and there, and it's just not really what happened for me. You know, I developed some really, well, I don't know if I developed them or not. Just some nasty habits we develop when we drink, and we drink like I do, you know, daily, and to the excess that I do, and that maybe some of you do, and so all those types of things were going on. You know, wet in the bed and scarring my face up and all that kind of stuff. This is a daily and a weekly thing for me, you know, and I'm willing to, again, I'm okay with that, you know. We're going to just set that aside because tonight's going to be a big night, you know. And I just was having a hard time coming up with rent, $335 a month for a one bedroom. It's crazy. I'd love to have that today. And my friends were terminating in a row, as Bill talks about in his story. They were going away. I was the lone wolf, as it were. And I was fine with that, too. And I'm hanging out in places that, after-hours type clubs, because, you go there by yourself, and the way I behave kind of fits in there, and it's okay. And I'm finding places to be comfortable to drink, I'm hanging out with my buddy Willie, who lives on the Map in Iron River, camping out with him in the woods on the weekend, And, Willie's just like me, drinking, daily drinker, get up in the morning and go at it, and, I'm unable to maybe break things when I'm hanging out in the woods when I'm drunk, and that kind of thing. My behavior's a little bit more acceptable when I'm in that environment, Like a werewolf, maybe, or something, I don't know. Like a bear, I don't know. But that's not the way I live today, I like hanging out in the woods, but it's not because of that, It was just gone. There was no desire to even try to quit. I mean, a couple of times that I would maybe try to moderate. My idea of moderation was maybe getting a 6-pack of tall boys as opposed to a 12-pack, that kind of thing. It was just uncomfortable to even think about having to control my drinking. Just the thought of it. Whatever. And that was just my patented response, and people would come to me, my employers were coming to me, my family were coming to me, and all of the, pleas to stop, the emotional appeals were, I just would just not talk. I would just shut my mouth, and that kind of thing. So, anyway, so I think you get the picture here. I mean, I've lost the power of choice in my drink, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable, here I am, I'm a committed drinker. We're just going to go for it, see what happens, And I don't know why I got a desire one day, but some events came about. My mom 12-stepped me, essentially. She showed up at my apartment one day. She had talked to me before, A lot of people talked to me about drinking. I don't know what was in it. There was nothing different about this day. She showed up with all the conference-approved literature in a box, threw it down on the apartment floor. By the time she left, I had mumbled something about not wanting to hurt her anymore, And the next day when I woke up, I considered it. I considered what it would be like. The thought came to me that what would your life be maybe, if you weren't drinking? I don't even know if that's the truth. The thought came to me like, we're going to give this a shot, We're just going to maybe not drink today, and I don't even know if that's really the exact words, but what happened is that day there was no alcohol consumed, I just didn't have any alcohol that day, and, 5 more days would pass, and I was kind of, sweating it out a little bit and all that kind of thing, and itchy and going nuts, and, but after about 5 days, I was like, okay, something's got to happen here. So I was doing some other stuff along the way, and I hadn't stopped doing these other things, so I continued on, and kind of developed Eric's own little recovery program for the next 5 or 6 months, I was just smoking a lot of grass, drinking a lot of Sharps, really becoming a connoisseur of the non-alcoholic beer, and, O'Doul's Amber. I don't know if you've seen it, but I was pleasantly surprised. I thought that was, going to work out okay, and it did work great for me for a while, and I'm not suggesting you go out there and do that. It's just what happened with me, and I refused to go to AA. I did not look at the books. I wasn't looking at anything that was dropped off. I just was convinced that if I really wanted to stop someday, by God, I could do it. Still was into this delusion. An illusion, really, is what that is. And I didn't even see that the fact that I had a desire was a gift. That was just God. It was just a gift for me. It was an act of providence, maybe. As it's said in some of our literature, and I believe that to be true. And I didn't believe that to be true for a long time in sobriety. Short time, I've been here that long, but the months were going by, and some of the things I was doing, smoking the grass was getting really uncomfortable. My chest was getting tight. I started dating this girl. I hadn't dated anybody in so long. God, I was just amazed that somebody wanted to go out with me. She didn't do that kind of thing, so I just let it go. you know, no problem. You know, I'm giving it for you, baby, you know. And, but, you know, God help her, she's trying to pry that sharps out of my hand. That's not going to happen, you know. And that relationship was kind of a flash in the pan. And so here I'm left, no weed, no nothing, you know, and I'm starting to get real nervous at this point. It's like December 19th of 99, and I went a couple weeks, you know, just with my sharps. And day after Christmas of 99, I went to my first AA meeting. And I don't know, that was a strange day. It was kind of like when the, you know, the other stuff stopped, then this thought pops into my head, maybe you should try to go to AA. I don't know where that came from either. You know, here's somebody who's committed not to go to AA. And I want to be like my mom. I don't want to have to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need to come into AA to stop drinking. I mean, what are you going to tell me? You're going to tell me not to drink? I know I'm not supposed to drink. Let's look at what's happened, you know. So, I mean, maybe I had some self-will left. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe, you know, God was, I'm sure, a big part of this. And so the thought pops in, go to AA. I was lonely. I was working in a bar. You know, and I was leaving the bar after work, and I, you know, it's just strange, you know, it was just really, it was a very surreal thing, and the thought just came to go, so I went, and I went to this called intergroup office, and I'm like, yeah, it's like this big announcement, yeah, coming in, you know, like they're going to be waiting for me, you know, there's some confetti at me or something, I don't know, silly thing like that, you know, you got me, you know. So I come in, I'm looking for a smoking meeting, you know, make a big deal out of it. I'm cutting jokes with the ladies. It's like, God, this meeting's at Madison Street, you know, come on down. So I started going to noon AA meetings. I was working at night in this bar, going to these noon meetings, you know, and, you know, drinking my sharps on the way to the meeting, you know, and all that kind of thing. And I would just call it drinking because that's what it is for me. I mean, that is when I know today what it is to be an alcoholic. I'm allergic to alcohol. I believe that I cannot have it in any form whatsoever. You know, I will never, ever be able to use alcohol in any form at all, ever. It's, you know, Dr. Chapina is a beautiful part when it talks about that. I like that word, never, for me. It closes the deal. Because I couldn't. I mean, it's strange when you drink a case of sharps a day. Well, people don't do that, you know. What's up with that? What's up with when you're counting them on a calendar? I don't know. You know, what's the difference between that and maybe taking a gallon of water and putting a couple of hot drops of Jack Daniels in it? Can I have that? Would that work out? I don't know. My mind starts working in little ways like that. You know, how is it going to work out? So, and people were trying to explain this to me in the meetings. Would you, Eric, you may want to stop drinking. You know, you may want to just set that aside. This one guy in particular, Andrew, big guy, he pulled me aside when I come into the meeting at the clubhouse there, and he was very kind, you know, he was showing me what kindness was about, and he was, you know, showing me with his actions, you know, and he was showing me love, you know, that's what we do here, and I didn't know what was going on, I just thought this big guy was trying to control the crap out of me. I'm like, you know, why is he getting up in my business about sharks, you know, not getting drunk, but he was pulling me aside, another guy pulled me aside, wrangled $6 out of me, and handed me a blue book, just kind of grinning from ear to ear, and so I had a bigger big book than the one my mom dropped off, which was good. And people were trying to help me, you know, and they were making some suggestions. And I was, you know, telling them about what I'd been doing. And, you know, I started getting really uncomfortable going to these meetings and doing what I was doing. I'd come home, crack open O'Doul's, and start trying to read some stories in the back of the book or something, you know. And that just wasn't making any sense. I'm looking at them like, I don't know, wasn't adding up. And, you know, it just stopped. The drinking just stopped on the 19th of January. It was the last day I drank. And my sobriety is on the 20th. It's my first day without a drink. You know, it's the last time. It's the first day of my sobriety. And I don't know why it just stopped. It just got to be uncomfortable for me to do it. It was objectionable to the point where I was unable to do it anymore. Not by anything that I was doing. What I was coming to some AA meetings, you know. And I wasn't even doing that because I even wanted to do that. Something else was at work here. I was sold on the fact that I did not need to come here, and I didn't want to come here, you know. I was really convinced of my self-will. It's funny when I look back at that. It's just funny that I see it in a different light today, and that's another big change for me. And Anyway, I saw a friend of mine in an AA meeting that I knew in high school. Have you ever seen anybody that you know from your past in an AA meeting? You're like, oh, God, what are they going to think, you know? All that kind of thing. Now, I'm thinking, you know, God, I hope I didn't do anything, ever do anything messed up there. And it was an old friend of mine, and she said, she's just like, hey, you know, all, you know, welcoming and being nice and clearly sober. You know, I wasn't really. It was just nuts. And she said, she made some suggestions, said, you know, you need to get a sponsor. Start coming, come over to this meeting on Wednesdays, and I want you to come over here. It's a meeting I chair on every Wednesday, and, you know, start looking for a sponsor. And I was just like, okay, whatever. Because I just think I don't need to come in here, and I just need to come into the meeting, and I'm going to leave. I'm not going to read anything. I'm not going to hand any chips out. Why everybody's shaking my hands all the time, and people are trying to hug me, and things like that. And I didn't really need see the need to participate at the level that everybody else was, you know. And, but you know, that kind of fell to the wayside after coming around for a little while. You know, my first sponsor would later explain to me that when we get together, and we talked about this in the meeting that we were at last night, when we get together in a room like this, and all we're all here, you know, to be of service to somebody who's newer, just to stay sober ourselves, all of that, you know. The group has to come first, but my sponsor would explain to me that the group, when we get here as a group, there's a power here that will not necessarily is here when we all maybe leave, when we go to the Bavarian Chef. You know, the power may not be here, you know, it's going to be at the Bavarian Chef, I'm sure. But there's a power in here. There's a, you know, there's a God here when we get together as a group that isn't here. And that's what, I guess, what was happening. You know, there's some kind of a power in an AA meeting. I don't believe that's the only thing that I need to stay sober, but it's a part of the triangle for sure. And these ideas that I had about what I needed to do and what I had to do or didn't have to do sort of kind of fell into the wayside. And I started listening to some of the things that people were saying, like get a sponsor. And so I did. I asked this guy, and he was very clear with me. You know, first he blew me off, and then I kind of came back at him at the end of the meeting. And it was very clear. He asked me some questions. He asked me if I wanted to stay sober. Was the first question that he asked me. And I said, yeah. And he asked me if I'd follow his instructions. And I said, yes. And then he gave me some instructions. And he told me to call him every day. He told me to get on my knees every morning and every night, thanking and asking for the strength to stay sober each day. And that was it. And he kind of just walked away and gave me his card. And so I started calling him every day. I didn't know what to think of it. You know, he just looked like a real nice old man. You know, and little did I know that he was like the hammer. You know, and he started dropping the hammer. You know, and that's exactly what I needed because I was just a little nuts when I got here, and just a little. I was like bouncing off the rails. You know, and he was just kind of. I think he just was trying to keep me on track. You know, I would run off in one direction. He just kind of snapped me back on the track. You know, and I'd come up with some crazy idea about something, and, you know, he would just reduce it with maybe three or four words of simplicity, you know. Don't drink. Click. You know, or something like that. I don't know. He took me through the steps, but he was a very just don't drink and go to meetings kind of guy. And, you know, but we went through the steps, all right. You know, he took me through the steps, and, I don't know. I think that what happened there is I followed his instructions. I became willing to listen to somebody else other than myself. And I just followed some instruction through somebody else's experience. And it was certainly sufficient enough to keep me sober and some type of a change to happen so I didn't take a drink in that first year. You know. And there's just a long list of things that I still practice principles that he, you know, would pass on to me. Even the simplest things. You know, he would say, love is action. Eric, if you love somebody, you do something for them. You know, he would tell me things like 97% of the things that you worry about never happen. You know, I'm like, but what about this? You know, this is going to happen. You know, he would say things like that, really simple things. He said, if you, what did he say? If you're doing something that bothers you, stop doing it. I was like, what do you mean by that? You know, stump me every time, you know. And I kept hearing all kinds of simple things in meetings. You know, one guy was talking about if you want to change something, why don't you start by putting the top back on your toothpaste every day, you know. And that sounds silly, but I went home and I started doing it, you know. I don't think a day has passed and I haven't put that thing back on, you know. And But I needed to, because I've dragged all my old behavior, all my habits in here to share with all of you. You know, all the things that I've done all my life, you know, and thank you for, you know, keeping me corralled and putting me back on track. And that's just what we do here. You know, we try to help other people by pointing this stuff out, being honest with them. And he certainly was with me. 3 months sober, he pointed out that I had been lying to him, you know. Heart attack. What do you mean I've been lying to you, you know? And my actions weren't meeting up with what I was saying in a certain situation, you know. And so that was, you know, an eye-opening experience. And he was talking about accountability. He would say, Eric, the most spiritual thing that you can do in a day is probably not pick up a drink. He said, but you also need to make sure that you do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. You know, we're accountable here, you know, and things like that. So I'm getting all these things. He's just always repeating himself all the time. Like, it's like a broken record. Why do you keep repeating yourself, Basil? You know, and anyway, it's because he loved me. You know, he knew enough about where I was. You know, like at 6 months sober, you know, he would make jokes about, like, you know, you were pretty banged up when you got here. You know, I saw a picture of myself when I was 6 months sober. Jeez, man. It's really scary. I mean, just, when I got here, I was about 135 pounds. You know, I had stopped eating, really, and I just was drinking myself, you know, into what we do, you know. Anyway, so, oh, boy. I was getting dragged from one meeting to the next, from one lunch, you know, at one hospital to another hospital every single day. And all these guys, they get together at a meeting, and then they go out to eat. Or they get together before the meeting, and it was just like this event to come to an AA meeting, you know. And I didn't understand, and I'd go to lunch, and I couldn't hear anything anybody was saying, you know. All you'd be talking, and my mind was just working like a, you know, Grand Central head is what they call it. That's what I had. And I just... And one day, it finally just kind of, I could hear the conversations that you were having, you know, and it stopped. It just kind of started to change a little bit. But they were showing me love. Again, they're dragging me out and taking me out places and doing things and, you know, encouraging me to do things that I would just not say yes to, you know, kind of forcibly putting me in sobering type situations, you know, and they're showing me the fellowship, you know, another important side of our triangle. And anyway, I went off to make amends when we got to that point, and, you know, I had a long laundry list of things that were pretty obvious that I had done that needed to go clean up, and a lot of my employers were right at the top of the list, you know, and one restaurant owner in particular was right there, and this is a guy that I'd seen him at a bar, and I wasn't working for him anymore, and I just went over to his table and just told him exactly what I thought of him, you know, in front of all his friends, made this big scene, you know. Here's the drunk guy, you know, you can see it now, and really... I was just humiliating myself. But anyway, I went back to make amends to this guy, and I was really afraid. This Italian guy, he's very big, and was very nervous about this amends. And, you know, he just kind of shrugged his shoulders, and he put his hand out, and he just said, you know, that's good. And he shook my hand, and that was it. And it's not really what he did, but the important part about all of the amends were, first of all, going out and making them at that point and following my sponsor's instruction. And the big part of it, too, is what he said, told me to say. He said, Eric, I don't want you to go and tell people you're sorry. I want you to go to them and you want to tell them that you were wrong. Because you've been wrong. You know, you're wrong. And you need to go admit that to people. And you need to make it right with them. And I started paying back some money. And I went down and I just did everything that I was supposed to do at that time. And it was like bricks were kind of coming off my chest. And I always talk about it that way because this is what was happening. I was no longer... kind of looking out around the room, you know, I was looking people in the eye, and I was getting comfortable, and a sense of peace and ease, I guess, was coming about me. You know, I didn't need to hide anymore from you, you know, and that was a huge change. I could never look anybody in the eye, you know, when you're drinking, you're always in a constant state of anxiety. It's like a nervous squirrel running around, you know, caught in two lanes of traffic. It's just kind of how I felt all the time, and this was going, this was leaving me. You know, I don't know which promise that is, but, you know, whatever. I mean, the action was being taken, and things were starting to happen. I was becoming a part of AA as a result of doing the work, you know. And he was encouraging me from the beginning to go and shake newcomers' hands and, you know, start being helpful to people. Shake everybody's hand in the meeting. Go up to that new guy and talk to him and, you know, we were going to the psych meeting. This was in the psych ward at 2 o'clock on every day of the week. This was a meeting that was up at the 7th floor of this hospital. And he had me tell my story of like 90 days or something. He didn't even tell me that's what was going to happen. He just kind of threw it on me. I was like, yeah, you're telling your story. You know? It's sweat pouring down. It's all about me, you know, all this kind of stuff. But he just got me into service. He just got me into motion. He's a very action guy, and that's what this is. This is an action program, you know. Give program to other people, and he was leading by example with that, and I'm just really grateful for that man. You know, he saved my life. He really did. He kept me alive while we worked together, and it was just a beautiful thing. And, you know, so a couple years into my sobriety, I had stopped practicing pretty much everything that our book suggests practicing. And I was just really trying to give it my best shot. You know, and I didn't trust God, and I was resentful across the board, and I'd been in and out of several unsuccessful relationships because I was a taker, and just a really, the selfishness and self-centeredness was just like I was when I got in here. You know, nothing had really changed. I just kind of digressed. I was kind of stuck maybe somewhere around the second or first step, you know, and I'm really lucky that I didn't drink, I'm sure. A lot of people do go through relationships and act the way that maybe they used to behave, and I don't know, man, maybe they stay, maybe they don't stay. But I was fortunate enough to run into somebody who I had met a few years before, and we were laughing about how much we had in common about resentment. You know, it was kind of funny, but resentment really isn't funny, you know, and I don't like resentments, and I don't enjoy them. People talk about those and mean, oh, I really like this resentment or whatever. No, that's not my truth, you know. It's not at all. You know, it's debilitating. It's like I might as well just be drunk, you know, because it's a whole different shut off, as it talks about. And I was clearly shut off when I ran into my sponsor, this woman who would become my sponsor, who's my sponsor today. And I didn't know she was going to be my sponsor. That's not what I had planned, you know. I just, yeah, I didn't know what to do. I had just run out of ideas, and I was in a tough spot. It was probably the closest I'd ever been to the third step in my life at this point. And she told me to come down and see her at the restaurant. And I did. And before I knew it, you know, she was taking me through our book from the first page, you know, right on through. And we were writing when it said to write. And you know, we were praying when we're supposed to pray and acting when we're supposed to act. And, you know, it took me through the program of recovery that we have here. And at that point, I didn't understand at all that I had lost the ability to control my drinking, and that I had nowhere along the line regained control just because I wasn't drinking, you know. I really kind of had been slapping myself on the back for staying sober, you know, and it was killing me. It really was, taking all the credit, you know, taking any credit, really, and no trust in God, and, you know, all my four-step was just like this. It was everything I came in here with. Nothing had changed, you know, and all the same people, all the same stuff. It was like the walls were closing in on me, and I just had no idea what was going on. And it's amazing when you go through and you take the steps and you follow the directions, you know, especially when it talks about setting aside old ideas, you know, in the second step. And I had plenty of them, and I needed to set them aside. And I would never have been able to do so unless I was convinced that I was a real alcoholic. And my whole problem really lied in the first step, because I really didn't understand that I was powerless. I was hopeless. Without some type of divine help, I would not have even come into AA. That's where I was going. And I believe maybe what I've told you about my story, you know, that speaks the truth. It's my truth. And I didn't see it that way. I was kind of had a reservation about who was keeping who sober, you know. That was the first idea that had to get worked out in order for me to even be willing to believe. Because at this point, I didn't believe in God. You know, God wasn't giving me what I wanted. I was playing God. I was God. You know, you make a list of what your God is, and that's what I was told to do. And you know, looking at that list, I'm like, damn, kind of looks like me, you know? Been playing God in my life, playing God in your life, trying to sponsor my family, sponsor whoever I can get my hands on, you know, to tell you what I think you should be doing. And I was getting some strange results. And, my four-step looked entirely different. Finally identified, well, I finally found out who I am and what I've been doing all my life. You know, I didn't understand what self-seeking was. I didn't understand any of that kind of stuff. You know, my first 4-step was kind of like, I'm mad at you. This is why I'm mad at you. When are we going to start feeling better? You know, that's kind of how it went. You know, and God bless my first sponsor, you know, and he's kind of agreeing with me on a couple of them. Yeah, that guy's this and that. And I'm like, yeah. But that's not the solution, you know. The deal is whenever I'm upset about something today, and I'm bothered by somebody or something, I've set the ball rolling. I've been setting the ball rolling all my life. I'm a bowler, you know. That's what I do. I mean, I step on people's toes. I create messes everywhere I go. I act out of, I'm just driven, you know, and we got to the 4th step, and I took this inventory, and, you know, there's a girl that I've been dating, and that had fallen apart, and so she, of course, she's my first resentment, and we get down to the questions of where I was. I was selfish, you know, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid, and so I finally, for the first time, all the truth came out, and really all my resentments were the same. All the way I've been behaving all my life have been the same. I'm not coming up with any new material here, you know. I just haven't been getting what I want. I get a little driven, and I try to just change the deck up a little bit and try to convince you of whatever I need to convince you of so I can get what I want to make me feel better. That about wraps it up for me. You know, and I do act out, and I play God, and I get just bizarre, and it offends people. You know, and I seem to forget what I've done, and then all of a sudden I'm left pointing the finger. And I spent my whole life being a victim, and for the first time in my life I saw it on paper. Here it is. Eric's been acting this way all his life, you know. And I don't know if it was a relief or what it was, but I tell you, when I shared my 5th step, and my sponsor started sharing some things that out of her experience and the resentments that she had, you know, it just wasn't that big of a deal, you know. I just had this idea that the steps weren't going to work for me. Somehow I was different. There's just no way. I'm willing to believe. I'll do the inventory. But a solution to all my problems? You know, not the way I feel right now. No way is this a solution to all my problems. We looked up the word vicissitude. No later circumstances, you know, would shake that cornerstone. Well, I'm here to tell you that's the truth. Nothing has shaken that cornerstone. And it's not like it's a... I had another old idea, like every day in sobriety was going to be... Because that's what I was shooting for when I was drinking. Every day is going to be like, you know, Busch Gardens or something. I don't know. People dancing around with steins of beer, you know, and that kind of thing. And everything's fine. Bills are paid. And I can think that that's the way I'm supposed to be today. That's the way I'm supposed to be today because I'm sober. And that's not the truth. That's just not the truth. And that's okay. That's fine. You know, and it's just taking time to kind of get used to that whole thing. But anyway, she pointed out some things to me that, you know, all these things, all this list of objectionable things you have here, these are for God to take care of. You know, and we're going to talk about some different behavior that you can practice, though, in order for maybe some of these things to change. And that's just the way it's been. It's just been practice, 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 you know, with my family, with my coworkers, with you, with everybody. I had a whole new list of amends to go make, all the trouble I caused in sobriety. And we went out and I made them, you know, and I went out and I got current with it, you know, and some things popped up from my past that I owed some money on, and I'm in the middle of paying those off right now. And it's a good thing, you know, it really is. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. I practice the 10th and 11th step the way it's talked about in the book. And I have an 11th step buddy, and I do 11th step with another person every night. And I've had times when I haven't done it, and times when I do it. There's a big difference. You know, for me, there's a whole level of accountability there that wasn't there before. You know, it's a blessing to be able to work with people today. You know, all my sponsors have given me the gift of time, their time. And they've sat down with me and they've spent a lot of time trying to help Eric. So I try to give that to people that I work with today. I don't just kind of bark off, go read this, go read that, and call me when you're done. That's kind of the avenue that I was rolling at when, you know, before. And that's just not what works for me. You know, I need to give it back like it's been given to me. And so we sit down and we go through the book. And, you know, these guys save my life on a daily, weekly, yearly basis. And it's a beautiful thing to watch other people have an experience. Watch them go maybe from where I know where I've been when I haven't done what our book tells us to do. And to see somebody come into that and then they have a change through God as a result of following some instructions or something. And that's what the deal is, you know. And It's not like a sit back and, wow, it's just wonderful for them. It's what I'm supposed to be doing. I mean, I understand that is my primary purpose today. And it's not like I wanted that or had that in the mix. It doesn't really even matter. I don't know why it doesn't matter. If I had my mind wrapped around some things that I wanted to do, then I would probably be dead. And I just believe that I have alcoholism, and I believe that the solution's working for me. So I'm trying to practice it with other people in the way it's suggested to do it, and it's been working good. It's working real good in my life today, I tell you. The meditation in the morning that I've been trying to practice has been awesome. It's just a matter of developing new habits today, it seems like. Especially into a fancy word for that, but I can't remember what it is. But anyway, vigilance, maybe, about getting up maybe a little bit early, and trying to do that. It's been really good. The work I have outside of my work life is different, too. I've been given a job that I never really thought that I wouldn't have picked where I am and what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm able to practice things here at work, tolerance of people. I treat the guys that I manage like I sponsor them. I spend time with them. I try to show them consideration and love through action. And it works. It works just great. I mean, it tells me that it would. And sure enough, it does, which is just fine, And my brother and my mom, and I try to treat them with respect. I don't try to sponsor them anymore. They don't want to be sponsored by me. We got 3 sober alcoholics in my family, and it can get a little strange around the holidays, and we all get together, and it's like, is it a meeting? Is it a, what are we doing here? And it doesn't make it any better when I act the way I act, So I just try to, the biggest spiritual thing I can do today is just keep my mouth shut across the board, those are the 2 things that my sponsor now carousing back in on, Keep your mouth shut and leave it alone. That's pretty much how I practice 6 and 7. I just leave it alone and keep my mouth shut, because I'm a fixer. I like get out there and I will just find a way. I'll show up, I'll suddenly, interfere with somebody else's life, and it's a mess. So I just have to really, when I get that feeling inside, like that driven feeling, at that point I need to turn the car around and go back home, I need to call somebody. And say, hey, this is what's going on in my head. And so we'll see. I'll let y'all know when that happens. I'll call and be like, Billy, you'll never believe I paused today. I was driven and I turned around. But it's not that bad. It's funny because those things come about and then end up bottoming out on something and then maybe you'll stop doing something, But it's all God's grace, really. I can't even tell you. I didn't come up with any stuff. I didn't need to be original about any of this stuff. It was all here for me, And all the sponsorship I've had has just shown me what I'm supposed to do. It's been another principle of practicing this thing, is following people's instructions, because I just didn't believe any of this stuff, really. I didn't understand it, and I didn't want to do it, So I just did the opposite of that. It's been good. I've had the opportunity to go to meetings outside of Virginia. I met a friend of mine in Alaska, went out there randomly, and he's got a really strong structured group out there, the Glacier Group, and they're kind of tied in with the Pacific Group. And good bunch of guys. I mean, it was just overpowering when I met them. I was like, God, everybody's running around in coat and ties. They got a coffee blocker, They had all this stuff going on at their meeting, and everybody's really enthusiastic about it, and it's very infectious, and he's become a very good friend of mine. He's been a very big help in our home group. It's kind of like their group kind of sponsors our group, maybe, so to speak, and we get a lot of really good direction. And it's just amazing to go out of town and visit other AA groups, because I always have a home wherever I go. My people, y'all are my people. We're in Madison. I'm here. I'm at home. And that happens wherever I'm able to go, if I get a vacation. It's a beautiful thing. So it works everywhere, and that's all I have to say tonight. I just want to thank you for having me.